From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Saddam Hussein was able to build his arsenal with weapons purchased in the international arms market. Journalist James Adams is an expert on the international arms trade. On this edition of Fresh Air, he tells us how the war has affected the arms race. Also today, we talk with director and screenwriter Paul Schrader about his new movie, The Comfort of Strangers. Schrader wrote the screenplays for Taxi Driver and The Last Temptation of Christ, and he directed American Gigolo and Patty Hearst. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews their new French movie, Daddy Nostalgia. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. While international discussions continue over the Kurdish refugees, there is little evidence their situation is improving. Stephen Jessel visited the one of the refugee settlements on the Turkish side of the border. He filed this report for the BBC.
One thing anyway has improved for the thousands scattered over the mountainside at Işik Verin, in a settlement too squalid and miserable to be called properly a camp. Most, if not all, now have protection from the rain in the form of tents or plastic sheeting strung between tree trunks long since stripped of their branches, which have been burnt on countless small fires. A few, members of a favored clan, are being taken 70 miles to a proper camp. But in many respects, matters are getting worse. Food and water are reaching the base of the mountain, but the distribution is still chaotic. Deliveries of bread are ambushed on their way up the slope, and the youngest and strongest still get most of it. Deliveries by helicopter are no better. A dozen American soldiers hold the crowd at bay until the helicopter lifts off, and then they're engulfed by thousands of refugees. Again, the strongest win.
Stephen Jessel reporting for the BBC. Authorities in Berlin today revealed that the former East German police, the Stasi, helped one of the world's top terrorists blow up a French cultural institute in Berlin in 1983. The attack, which killed one person and wounded 23 others, was evidently masterminded by the Venezuelan terrorist known as Carlos the Jackal. More from NPR's Tom Jelton in Berlin.
It's long been rumored that Carlos the Jackal was given refuge in East Germany in the 1970s and 80s at the peak of the terrorist period, but there was never official confirmation. The Berlin prosecutor's office now says, however, that recently discovered Stasi files show that an anti-terrorist department within the Stasi actually helped terrorist groups, including the one led by Carlos the Jackal. A spokesperson for the prosecutor says an arrest warrant in connection with the 1983 bombing here was issued last week for the Stasi agent who directed the department. The report of Stasi ties to Carlos the Jackal is only the latest in a series of charges that the East German secret police worked closely with terrorist groups. Two German newspapers earlier this week reported that the Stasi assisted the Palestine Liberation Organization in planning to carry out assassination attempts in West Germany. I'm Tom Jelton in Berlin.
The nation's freight trains are now rolling on the rails today after the government stepped in to stop a 19-hour strike. But the dispute that led to a walkout of more than 200,000 workers is still unresolved. Both rail companies and unions will now make their cases on wage and work rule disputes to a special review panel. If no new agreement is reached between management and the unions, the panel will impose a mandatory settlement for both sides. On Wall Street, the Dow fell 5 points to close at 2999.25. This is NPR. President Bush has unveiled a new strategy of national achievement tests to prepare students for the next century. The plan will also call for the creation of non-traditional schools, some of which could be operated by private businesses. It also seeks voluntary national achievement testing for 4th, 8th, and 12th graders in a variety of subjects. It suggests that higher pay be awarded to those who teach well, or in dangerous or challenging settings, or to those who act as mentors to new teachers. Lawmakers in Utah have rejected an attempt to appeal that state's restrictive abortion law. They also revised the law to give it a better chance of surviving court challenges. NPR's Howard Berkus reports from Salt Lake City.
Utah legislators met in a special session to reconsider what is called the most restrictive abortion law in the country. One member of the Utah House introduced a bill that would have repealed the law. Representative Haynes Fuller called the abortion statute an embarrassment to Utah, but his attempt to repeal it was overwhelmingly defeated. Lawmakers then revised the law in an attempt to quell some of the embarrassment and to make the law more palatable to federal courts. They did away with the possibility that women undergoing abortions could face capital murder charges. They also broadened the law so that any victim of incest would be able to receive an abortion. The law won't take effect until the courts have ruled on its constitutionality. It would ban 98% of the 4,000 abortions now performed yearly in Utah. I'm Howard Berkus in Salt Lake City.
Donald Trump has won a new license to keep his Taj Mahal casino today, but there are some conditions. The New Jersey Casino Control Commission might take the building away if Trump doesn't cut his crippling debt in the next 2 months. The commission voted 4-1 to renew the license for Atlantic City's biggest casino, even though Trump didn't have enough money to support his three casinos in case they fall short of cash.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Several Western democracies armed Saddam Hussein, only to end up fighting him in the Gulf War. The war showed off America's new smart weapons, and now a lot of countries want to buy them. What effect has the Gulf War had on the arms race? My guest James Adams wrote about how dictators build their arsenals in his book Engines of War, Merchants of Death and the New Arms Race. He investigated covert military forces around the world in his book Secret Armies. Adams is also defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London. I spoke with him earlier today from the NPR Bureau in London and asked him if international arms sales are up in the wake of the war.
I think it's a bit early to say yet because you don't get the result of something like this for quite some time. What matters is, will the war increase or decrease the amount of arms sales over the next 12 months, couple of years? And the answer almost certainly seems to be yes, it will. But as far as the war itself is concerned, the significance of it is not its instant impact on arms sales, but how the war will alter the pattern of arms sales in the future, perhaps for the next decade or so.
Now, what about the countries who were our allies in the Middle East? Are we rewarding them for their support sending them more arms?
Yes, very definitely, because obviously we have a debt to pay, and people signed up on the coalition side, not because they necessarily thought the coalition was a wonderful thing, but because they saw some benefit, both political, economic, and military. So for countries like Saudi Arabia, they will be expecting fighter aircraft, tanks, minesweepers, and so on from the Allies. Whether they'll be simply from the United States or not remains to be seen, but they will expect that kind of payoff, just as Israel will expect a payoff for showing what it describes as restraint in not retaliating against Iraq.
Now, the Bush administration, I believe, wants to send about $14 billion worth of arms to the Saudis.
Yes, that's right. And it looks like that'll go through. I don't think there's going to be the congressional objections. This is an arms deal that's been in the works for ages, and Congress has been trying to prevent it under pressure from the Israeli lobby. It looks as if that's now not going to survive the war. So those arms will go through. In addition, you've got a $20 billion package from the British that will be going to Saudi Arabia. And so, in a sense, the war has freed up a lot of the deals that were in the pipeline, a lot of the political restraint, whereas some people, I think, had been hoping that what the war would produce would be more, not less, restraint.
Now, what about Turkey, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, also countries who supported the United States and Britain? Are we sending them arms to maintain the balance of power and to support U.S. security objectives in the Gulf?
Well, we have agreed, this context, the United States has agreed to send Patriot missiles and fighter aircraft to Egypt. Turkey is going to get fighter aircraft. The UAE is looking for tanks and will probably get them, and is also looking for Patriots and will probably get those also. And that's just the sort of front-end stuff. And then there'll be plenty of other missiles, ground systems of one kind or another, new airfields, communications. So we're looking at across the board pretty comprehensive packages of arms, equipment, and support for almost all those countries that were involved. It remains to be seen whether Syria, a traditional ally of the Soviet Union, will come into the market from the West. But certainly the Soviets will want to be replacing and reinforcing the Syrian armed forces in the same way as we are with the Saudis.
Now, if the United States is sending weapons to these countries in the hope of keeping a balance of power that would be favorable to the United States, what are the risks here?
Well, I think the reward for doing this kind of thing is that you get political influence and cash or oil or whatever you sort of deal you do. The risk is that by arming, you actually make a non-aggressive country adopt an aggressive posture. They say to themselves, well, we've got all this wonderful death-dealing stuff. Let's see if it actually works. And as Iraq did, launch an attack upon a neighbor. So the argument, I suppose, is a very simple one, that the more weapons you supply, they are not, as some would have it, stabilizing and producing security in a region, but are actually very destabilizing. And you just end up with an accelerating cycle of each country needs to buy more arms to defend itself against an increasingly well-armed neighbor. And it's very difficult to break out of that cycle. And some had hoped that the Iraq war might provide an opportunity to do just that.
Do you think it's short-sighted for the United States to be sending high-tech weapons to countries that might be friendly to the United States now? These deals might look good economically for America right now, but there's always the chance that one of these countries will be the next Iraq, that it will turn from what the United States perceived as an ally to what the United States perceived as an enemy.
Yes, of course it's short-sighted, but then one has to deal with the real world. And I think it's impossible to say now who tomorrow is going to be the next ruler in, let us say, Saudi Arabia. I can write you a paper today saying that Saudi Arabia will have the same ruling family in 20 years' time. I can write you another paper just as convincing to say that the regime will fall in 6 months. And you just don't know. Now, all arms traffic has a risk attached to it. And the political world is all about short-term advantage and to hell with the long-term consequences. And the arms business is the absolute quintessential example of that. But it's reality we're dealing with. You can argue that you could actually manage the arms business better so that the risk was reduced and you tried to break away from this apparently endless cycle of proliferation. And that's a perfectly coherent argument. But you're never going to convince politicians not to be short-sighted. It kind of goes with the job.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Adams, and he's the defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London and the author of several books on terrorism, covert warfare, and the new international arms merchants. I was reading that 6 of the world's top 10 arms merchants are Western democracies. What's in it for the democracies who are sending arms besides the political manipulation that they hope to accomplish? What's in it financially?
Well, there's a lot of money involved because you get, let's say, Britain exported about $8 billion worth of arms last year. Now, for every dollar of gun or shell or whatever that you export, that's jobs back home, significant numbers of jobs in Britain. There are about 500,000 people employed one way or another in the defense industries. And so you're looking at political influence back home, because the politicians are able to say, well, we've got a thriving industry and industry is good and keeps the people happy. You also have got the value of getting the exports that where you sell arms, you get influence, and therefore hopefully you sell hospitals, if you like, or schools or other parts of the social infrastructure, which give you greater influence again. So it's not just a matter of here's a gun, give us the money. It's here's a gun, and that allows us to pass on other things and gives us significance back home. So there is a multi-layered argument of why arms sales are actually a good thing. There's equally counter-arguments that it's a bad thing. But still, there are very strong arguments why one should proceed, which is why in the last few years there's been a significant change in the way the arms business is run, where before it was a kind of dirty business and done by all sorts of seedy characters. These days, prime ministers and presidents are there to sign the deal themselves and play a very important role in setting them up, too.
Now, the Pentagon is planning to cut back on the defense budget. Does that mean that American manufacturers, American arms manufacturers, will want to approach more foreign clients to make up the difference?
Absolutely, and it's not just America. This is going to be a key factor of the arms trade for the next decade or longer, in that all countries are cutting back their defense budgets at the moment. So, for example, McDonnell Douglas, they make the F-15. The F-15 production line will be running out this year, next year. The next fighter replacement will not be coming in perhaps till 1996, somewhere in there. So in between, they've got to sell stuff. And they've got to sell them to countries abroad, obviously, because they haven't got a homegrown outlet. Now, they're just one. British Aerospace in England, same problem with the Tornado. The French with the Mirage, exactly the same problem. So you go around the world, and in each major arms producer for each different type of weapon, you're seeing orders falling from their indigenous outlets, their normal home outlets, and they have got then to export to survive, or they close. And they don't want to close, they want to survive. So they go out and they're all touting their business like mad and all competing very much with each other. And into that mix, you've got reductions of just standard equipment, for example, in the Eastern Bloc, where they're cutting their armed forces wholesale, and because of conventional arms treaties, similarly, weapons are coming onto the market. And all of this means that you've got a much, much more competitive arms trade than has ever really existed in the past. Cutthroat stuff, where people are saying, well, I'll give it to you for $100, no, I'll give it to you for $80, I'll give it to you for $50, I'll give it to you if you give me some bananas in exchange. So it's a business that must, in the end, result in increased proliferation of all different types of weapons to whole new markets that are going to open up, which I think is a pretty worrying prospect.
Now, what are the illegitimate ways of getting weapons? And I guess this is where the arms merchants come in.
Well, in their case, the way arms exports are organized is that if you say they're in a warehouse in Miami, there is a supply of Stinger missiles. To take those missiles out of the warehouse in Miami and take them to Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, you have to get what is called an end-user certificate, which somebody in Saudi Arabia has to sign that certificate, some government official, to say, yes, I have ordered these missiles, I want them, and they're going to be used for my army. And on that basis, the export is allowed and the customs will allow them to leave. So the key thing in doing any illegal trade is to find some willing soul who will sign the end user certificate for presumably a large sum of money. And instead of the weapons going to, let us say, Manila in the Philippines, which used to be a useful outlet for forged end user certificates, instead of it going to Manila, it ends up in Afghanistan, say. Well, you can do that if you've got the end user certificate and you're not too fussy about breaking the law and paying out plenty of bribes. But the sort of money that you're talking about is so huge on some of these deals that there are enough corrupt officials around where there really isn't any problem, if that's the sort of business you want to do, in finding people to produce the fake documentation, and then you just need one of these venal characters who don't really care who they sell to and when to get on with the business.
Do arms merchants get some of their arms from United States sources too?
The U.S., in terms of complying with the law, is pretty good. It's the difficulty you get in terms of a country like the United States, where there is very high technology equipment that is available from, let us say, portable computers to guidance systems to microchips. You run into the difficulty of dual-use capability, where a particular item that I say is used to make soap suds someone else of a less benevolent attitude may say, well, I can actually use this stuff to make chemical weapons. And that's the difficulty you get in a country like the US or in Britain, where a lot of dual-use equipment has been sent to a number of countries, and that's where the law is extremely weak and the control mechanisms not adequate.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Adams, the defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London and the author of several books on terrorism, covert warfare, and the new international arms merchants. We'll take a short break and we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. James Adams is my guest, the defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London. Did the Gulf War change which weapons countries wanted most?
I think so, because what you saw in the Gulf War was the performance of high technology weapons, so-called smart weapons, and also of what the military call the standoff weapon, where essentially you're sort of out of visual sight and you fire something and you can guide it to its target a long way away. This is an attractive option because it keeps your own soldiers and airmen less vulnerable. So you've seen the apparently successful performance of a lot of very high technology equipment, which resulted in two things. One, the successful prosecution of the war by the coalition, and two, very, very light casualties on the coalition side. And both of those things will mean that you will have, they will be the preferred weapons of the future. This has been a trend, of course, that has been continuing for some time, but there's been a debate about should you go to the high-tech stuff because it's terribly expensive and does it work and so on, and why not keep low-tech and just have things that are fairly robust and will do the job. So you will see much more high-technology equipment coming onto the market, in part, of course, because the manufacturers will be able to say, here is this, it's been tested in battle and proved to work, whereas the Soviets will be able to say, this has been tested in battle and I'm afraid it didn't work very well. So there will be a change or a greater emphasis on high technology equipment as a result of the war.
There was testimony earlier this week at the House Armed Services Committee. Several scientists questioned the efficiency of the Patriot missiles, they said that the exploded debris might have caused more damage than if the Patriot wasn't used at all. If there had been chemical weapons, the gas would have been spread more. The gas might have been more effective in killing people than it would have been if not for the Patriots. And basically, the use of the Patriot was questioned as a weapon in populated urban areas where the debris could, you know, knock down houses and kill people as well. What's your impression about that?
I think that's absolutely right, but then I don't think that's the whole argument. You can sit in some congressional committee and pontificate about these things, but the reality was, at the time, that Israel was being attacked, and indeed was Saudi Arabia, being attacked by these terror weapons coming out of the sky, which they would suddenly appear and hit populated areas. And the Israelis, quite understandably, were saying, this is intolerable. We must have something to defend ourselves. And lo and behold, riding out of the West came the Patriot missile. And it started to shoot these things out of the sky. And yes, sure, there was debris. And yes, there were casualties caused. And yes, perhaps you can have a better weapon. But the key point about the Patriot was that it kept Israel out of the war. And it provided the psychological reassurance that was absolutely right and absolutely necessary at that time.
Now, let me ask you about arms control. There are treaties that limit the proliferation of chemical and nuclear weapons, ballistics. Where do smart weapons fit into that?
They don't really, because there is no limitation in... People don't look at, really, guidance. They look at performance in terms of distance or in terms of payload, which... Actually, it's an interesting question because there is a common misconception, I think, that warfare carried out with nuclear weapons, whether they be tactical or rather larger, or carried out with chemical weapons is somehow dirty, and war carried out by conventional means is somehow really rather nice. And I just think this is completely crazy. War carried out with conventional weapons these days, because they are so smart, because explosives, conventional explosives, are so much more powerful than they were 10, 20 years ago, conventional warfare is an unbelievably brutal and terrible business. And limiting tactical nuclear weapons is great. Of course you should limit tactical nuclear weapons, but conventional weapons these days are horrific. And you have to really address that issue as well if you're serious about arms control. But sadly, somehow people just don't seem to hoist this on board, and that is an effect that is that is an image, in fact, that has been perpetuated by the Gulf War, where if you ask anyone, okay, what was the war like, and they'll say it was a precision clean war, and how many people's bodies did we see blown to pieces? Answer: mostly we didn't see any, and yet there were, depending on who you speak to, 50,000, 100,000, maybe more Iraqis killed. And being killed in war is not a pleasant experience. And yet we've got this completely artificial impression of what war is about, which makes, of course, the whole issue of arms control much more difficult, because people think, hey, it's okay, really, which, of course, it isn't.
Do you think that these new smart weapons should be included in arms control treaties?
I don't think it's so much an issue of smart weapons, because you would have an impossible definitional problem of saying, well, what's a smart and what's a stupid weapon, and should this particular bullet that does this particular type of thing be included in or not? The issue is not that. It's it is the fact of arms control at all levels that is important, not really so much whether this does this or this does the other. You have to somehow do enough to persuade the arms-producing nations not to sell to anybody, and the arms-buying nations to be restricted on how much they can actually purchase. And it's doing that that matters, not so much saying, well, this is a good weapon or this isn't, or this should be restricted or that shouldn't, but it's dealing with the whole range of problems raised by proliferation.
Well, it sounds like a lot of Western democracies aren't interested in seeing that kind of conventional arms control because of the political and economic advantages they think they get out of selling weapons to other countries.
I think there's some truth to that. I mean, there has been talk, as I'm sure you know, in the Bush administration and among other allies of the United States, such as Britain and France, where in the euphoria and immediately after the war, people were talking about reducing the amount of weapons that are sold conventionally and in every other area, by saying, okay, we, perhaps the UN Security Council, will all sign up to a new level of a lower level of arms sales, and we will police it. And there was a lot of optimistic talk, but now that things have settled down a bit and it's getting back to more business as usual, there's been less of this. And the longer you wait, the less likely it is that anything is going to happen. And the more greed will come to the fore, and people want to sell everything they can to anyone. So I think it's rather depressing, but there does seem to have been an opportunity that looks like being lost. And it was, I would think, a once-in-our-lifetime opportunity where there was leadership from the United States, there were countries prepared to do things, and one doesn't really see any sign of that being built on, which is a great tragedy for which our children and our children's children will probably have to pay a rather heavy price.
James Adams is defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London and author of the book Engines of War. He spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in London. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we talk to filmmaker Paul Schrader about the dramatic use of violence, physical and psychological. Schrader wrote the screenplays for Taxi Driver and Raging Bull, and he directed American Gigolo, Patty Hearst, and the new film, The Comfort of Strangers. Also, Stephen Schiff has a review of the new movie, Daddy Nostalgia. Steven says it'll make you glad the French are still making movies. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The government of Iran has made its first comment on the Kurdish crisis since U.S. troops began setting up refugee camps in northern Iraq. NPR's John Hockenberry reports from Tehran.
Iran is in a difficult political position as U.S. forces begin establishing bases in northern Iraq for refugees. Iran has wanted all along for Saddam Hussein to be severely weakened or toppled as a result of the Gulf War, but with a minimum presence of allied troops. Yet the Kurdish refugee crisis has, if anything, increased Iran's dependence on the Western nations it is most suspicious of. Today, Iran's President Ali Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani said that Kurdish refugees would be cared for in Iran until it was safe for them to go home. The Iranian president studiously avoids commenting on the U.S. troop presence in northern Iraq. A commentary on Tehran Radio today said that the allies should concentrate on ending bloodshed in Iraq rather than enlarging their military presence. Clearly, Iran hopes to benefit from the international effort to repatriate the Kurds, yet it looks more and more as though Iran will have to give up its coveted political isolation to do so. This is John Hockenberry in Tehran.
Amnesty International says that hundreds of people in Kuwait have been arrested, scores killed, and many tortured since that country's liberation. The human rights organization charges that abuses are continuing and the victims are mainly foreign workers. NPR's Michael Scholar has more.
The new Amnesty International report is based on a fact-finding mission in Kuwait that ended 10 days ago. The Amnesty team says it confirmed stories that Palestinians and other foreign workers have been taken from their homes, from the streets, or from city checkpoints, often to be jailed, tortured, and sometimes killed. The motive was often revenge against people thought to have collaborated with the Iraqis, but the report says many people were targeted simply because of their nationality. The Kuwaiti army has been implicated in recent cases. Amnesty International could not determine the extent of the abuse, but notes that 600 people are now held in a government jail. The organization says Kuwait's rulers have given an extremely low priority to human rights violations. This is Michael Scholar in Kuwait City.
Both U.S. and Iraqi officials have agreed to hold their first direct talks in northern Iraq. The Pentagon says that U.S. military teams are looking in northern Iraq for sites for refugee camps. A Pentagon spokesman says that U.S. troops so far have had no face-to-face contact with Iraqi military forces. Iraq has been warned not to interfere with efforts to aid and protect the Kurdish refugees. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 5 points to close at 2,999.25 on volume of some 217 million shares. This is NPR News. Under President Bush's education plan, there is very little new federal spending, with the program calling on states, governors, teachers, and local communities to make advances. Mr. Bush does say that he will ask Congress for $690 million to start up new types of schools, some of which may be operated by private business. The plan also calls for nationwide voluntary testing in 5 key subjects in the 4th, 8th, and 12th grades. The president also said that he will press for giving parents more choice in education, including whether or not to send their children to a public or private school. U.S. Secretary of State Baker arrived in Israel tonight for his third round of talks in 6 weeks. He will try to iron out details of proposals for a regional peace conference. Linda Gradstein has more from Jerusalem.
Secretary Baker's schedule in Israel this time is similar to his two other trips. Tomorrow he will meet the Israeli Prime Minister and Foreign and Defense Ministers. On Saturday he will meet a group of Palestinian leaders. On the agenda is a regional conference under American and Soviet auspices. But Israel and the Arab states see the conference very differently, and Baker will try to bridge this gap. Syria has demanded that the conference be under UN auspices, a demand Israel has repeatedly rejected, although Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir hinted today that perhaps the Europeans could be observers. The Palestinians have also demanded that Israel stop expanding Jewish settlements in the occupied territories, a step Israel refuses to take. But Baker says he is committed to bringing both sides together and may return to Israel next week after his meetings in Arab capitals. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
This country's trade deficit moved down to its lowest level in more than 7 years in February. The Commerce Department says that there was a $1.8 billion drop in the country's trade deficit to its lowest level since September of 1983. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My guest, Paul Schrader, wrote the screenplays for several provocative, well-known films like Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, and The Last Temptation of Christ. And he directed some provocative but lesser-known films like Blue Collar, Hardcore, Mishima, and Patty Hearst. Schrader's new movie, The Comfort of Strangers, is based on a novel by Ian McEwan. The screenplay was written by Harold Pinter. The story is about a British couple on vacation in Venice who fall under the spell of an older couple living in Italy. The younger couple, the Innocents, is played by Natasha Richardson and Rupert Everett. The older, sinister couple who seduces them into their sadomasochistic fantasies is played by Christopher Walken and Helen Mirren. Schrader told me what interested him in The Comfort of Strangers.
Not so much the story as the characters, you know, and the morality. You know, it is not, you know, as they say in Hollywood, it's not story-driven. It is character-driven. And it is just saturated with the moral and sexual ambiguity of behavior. And any of the characters can be read in a number of ways. And I love that. I love that in life, and I love that in art.
The younger couple, the couple who's on vacation in Venice, is not having a very good time toward the beginning of the movie. They're disoriented. They're alienated. They're not even getting along very well. They haven't been making love. They've seen the sights before. So they don't know what they're doing there. Like, what's the point of this vacation? They're even thinking of going home. Anyways, and in some ways it's almost comic. Do you know what I mean? But we're on vacation. I wonder if you related to that at all, about the pointlessness of vacation sometimes.
Or, in this case, the vulnerability of of tourists. You know, people often end up doing things and going places on vacation that they would never dream of doing at home because it's an adventure. And that, you know, we all have our delicious tales we tell of the time we were in Morocco or in Mexico, and we ended up on this dark road in this strange house or this little cafe, and it's all very romantic. And it's into this kind of romantic vacuum that these characters drift.
Christopher Walken and Helen Mirren play an older couple, and he's the son of an Italian diplomat living in an elegant house, and you could tell right away there's something very unsavory about him, and you could tell right away that there's something very sadistic about him. And although the younger couple doesn't much like him, it kind of ignites this attraction to each other, and they end up making love for days. Do you think that it's dangerous to flirt with danger?
I like that slip of the tongue, making up love.
Is that what I said?
You asked if I thought it was dangerous.
To flirt with danger.
Well, yes, but it's fun.
Now you worked with a script by Harold Pinter. How would you characterize his screenwriting?
Well, to characterize his screenwriting, you have to back up to his his playwriting in general. You know, and the innovation that Harold brought to the theater 30 years ago was this notion that indirection in dialogue is just another form of direction, and that if a character doesn't talk about a thing long enough, he ends up talking about it. Or, to use another metaphor, you can look at a rock long enough and you will see the bugs underneath. You don't actually have to pick it up. So he often writes dialogue that seems to be meandering, seems to be repetitive, seems to be almost an incantation. But it is very much to a point, and the point is language itself as a mask.
Now, what does that leave you to do as the director? Are there things that you have to put in visually that are not in the script because of the kind of elliptical writing that he does?
Yeah, well, first of all, he has no descriptions in the script. You know, it's
just the dialogue.
Interior room, and then you go to the dialogue. So everything that is on screen has to be imagined. And then you have to decide how aggressive a player the camera is in the drama. If you have a scene with two people talking, there's always three people in the scene because there's the two people who are talking and then there's the third person who's watching them. And how active or passive that person is who is watching them is a directorial decision. Most films like to pretend that the third person is not present, so they hide the presence of the camera. In this case, I decided to go the other way and make the audience always aware of the drifting, voyeuristic, sometimes bored mind of the camera, of the voyeur watching the drama. And I felt that the story was so, shall we say, kind of perverse or morbid, and the humor was so kind of dark that I had to mask it in glamour. You know, it's like someone gives you a particularly rotten apple and you have to go sell it. You know, well, you shine it up and really cosmeticize it, and hopefully someone buys it and thinks it's so beautiful that until they bite into it and find their mouth full of worms and maggots. And I guess that's how I decided to treat the story and the language and to lend a kind of dreamlike floating glamour to it.
We know at the beginning of the movie, I was really wondering what you were doing because it seems so unlike you. The beginning of the movie is, you know, a beautiful sunset, gorgeous scenes of Venice. And it's almost, European in the sense, you know, the kind of European film that has, like, beautiful, elegant images, and it's kind of boring. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, I think that if there is something that distinguishes European and American cinema, it's not the beauty of the image, because Americans make extremely beautiful films as well. It's the priority that is set on plot versus character. And I think the Europeans are a little more comfortable letting the drama rest with the character and the theme, so that when the story is not being driven with the impact of a Hollywood film, you do have more time to absorb the beauty of the cinematography, and therefore you think it is more beautiful.
But here's what I think I was getting to, that in the beginning scenes, I was thinking that this is a much more high art interpretation of beauty, you know, elegant sunsets, beautiful architecture, Venice, which kind of signifies European, as opposed to, with the exception of Mishima, you're usually very kind of American subject matter, and you're much more kind of colloquial approach to it.
Well, it's also, I did a film, American Gigolo, which has all of that you know, arty-farty junk in it, too.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is screenwriter and film director Paul Schrader. He directed the new movie, The Comfort of Strangers. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Paul Schrader is my guest if you're just joining us. He directed the new film, The Comfort of Strangers. He also wrote the screenplays for Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, and The Last Temptation of Christ, and directed American Gigolo, Hardcore, Mishima, and Patty Hearst. I want to ask you a little bit about the actors that you cast in The Comfort of Strangers. I think the acting is really quite good. The man in the older couple is Christopher Walken, who is, as far as I'm concerned, an actor we don't get to see enough of in American films. And tell me what you saw in him when you cast him for this role. I think he's just terrific at embodying a certain kind of menace.
Well, the criterion for casting that role was the character has a 10-minute speech.
Right.
And he gives it in a seated position. And that is simply an acting discipline and ability that very few actors possess. And, you know, Chris is one of those actors. So I would have preferred the actor to be more Italian, you know. Unfortunately, both Pacino and De Niro were working at the time, and those were the only other two actors I could think of. But then I very quickly got to Chris, who was available, because I knew he could do this, and I'd seen him do it on stage. And in fact, all four actors, which is Natasha Richardson, Rupert Everett, and Helen Mirren, all of them have a lot of stage experience, because I needed actors who could read a line in more than one way, who could shade and flavor a line as the conversation progressed, rather than actors who simply give up themselves in the same way every time.
I want to talk with you a little about the subject of violence. Violence as a release, as a form of release or even redemption, is a kind of recurrent image in movies that you've directed and written. And I would use Taxi Driver as an example and The Comfort of Strangers as another. And I'm wondering, I mean, I could ask this more on an abstract level, but I'm wondering on just a physical level, if you were ever the victim of violence or participated in any violence yourself, or if your interest in it is, you know, a much more intellectual, metaphorical interest.
Yeah, but also psychological. You know, I'm something of a claustrophobe. I'm not nearly as bad as I used to be. But that sense of being trapped, of being caught, and of having to strike out to save your life, you know, sort of permeates my psychology. I haven't really participated in violence, and I don't particularly enjoy going to violent movies. And to be honest, I don't particularly make them. You know, in my entire career, I've killed fewer people than Bruce Willis has in 5 minutes. What I do traffic in is psychological violence, which is, in fact, much more oppressive than cartoon violence. So even though there aren't many bodies and there aren't many gun hits and there isn't much blood, there is a feeling of violence, you know, particularly like the first film I directed, Blue Collar. It just radiates violence and tension, even though it's not a violent movie. So to some degree, I've been unfairly stuck in that violence box, and I think that's wearing off now, though.
But when you do have a violent scene, it really counts for something, and there is this sense of release. You feel like everything's been building to this all along.
Yeah, well, I like that thing in Japanese art, you know, which is it goes in through all the arts, Japan, and singing and painting and calligraphy. You know, it's repression, 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 and then all of a sudden, boom, explosion, you know. And the rapid shift from holding back to letting go, which is a mark of Japanese art, is one that I share.
Do you think that the repression that you went through as a child, because you came from a very strict fundamentalist upbringing where there was so much that you weren't allowed to do, do you think that contributed to your interest in that sensibility of repression?
Well, if it walks like a duck and looks like a duck, maybe it is a duck.
All right. What do you think your reputation is now in the movie industry?
um, That's a nice question. I think I'm kind of make it his own way filmmaker who is respected and given some slack on the cusp, you know, because that's where I am. I'm sort of on the cusp of the industry. But, you know, if you understand the industry, you also know that people who finance films know better than the public how close the circumference of the economic circle is to the locus, and that the man who made Eraserhead can make Elephant Man 2 years later, you know, so that being on the cusp of the industry doesn't mean being out of the industry.
Do you find that the kind of movie that you want to make changes as you get older, either the subject or the style?
Yes, of course. And, you know, that anger thing goes, you know, the thing of the 20s, you know, I'm going to force my way into this world and I'm going to make them put up with me. And then they do put up with you, and so that calms down. You know, I have two children, a house in the suburbs, you know, anxiety starts to replace anger. So the themes do change.
Paul Schrader directed the new movie, The Comfort of Strangers. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, President Bush said today he wants a revolution in education in America.
He has a few ideas. He has a strategy, for example, of non-traditional schools, some to be operated by businesses. He's also proposing differential pay for those teachers who do a good job or who teach in dangerous situations. We'll have a report on the program. Also, Ira Glass reports on difficulties involved in starting up a microbrewery in Chicago. And I'll have a conversation with Robin Holcomb, a musician now based in Seattle, mostly about the song Deliver Me. It's inspired by the Harriet Arno book, The Dollmaker.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The French filmmaker Bertrand Tavernier is probably best known to American audiences for his 1986 film Round Midnight, about an aging American jazz musician living in Paris. Tavernier's new movie is Daddy Nostalgia. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
With its icky title and its sometimes irritating mannerisms, Daddy Nostalgia isn't the greatest French movie you've ever seen, not by a long shot. But it's good enough to remind us of what once made French movies so special. It has that familiar, breathtaking intimacy, that literacy and tenderness, and it has an insouciant way of shrugging off the demands of plot and storyline to get at something deeper and more touching. Look at the other big French movies around at the moment. Cyrano de Bergerac, like Jean de Florette before it, is the kind we in America seem to be gobbling up these days. We don't make costume period pictures anymore because they're too expensive, so the French do it for us. Then there's the new hit La Femme Nikita, a ghastly pop art shoot-em-up that plays like a Helmut Newton photograph in motion. The heroine looks like a model, lives with her schlumpy boyfriend, and has a secret life as a top assassin for the French government. Right. The director, Luc Besson, is trying to make a gut-wrenching American action picture with a little ooh-la-la on top. By contrast, Bertrand Tavernier isn't trying to do anything except zero in on the tiny landscape he's carved out for himself. Daddy Nostalgia's heroine, Caroline, played by Jane Birkin, is a struggling writer in Paris who's just left her husband. Now her English father, played by Dirk Bogarde, is dying in a little town on the Riviera, and Caroline travels down to nurse him and to comfort her mother, a Frenchwoman played by Odette Laure. the mother has become ingrown and stern, the father frightened and yet eager to wrench just a little more pleasure from life. The daughter wants to give and get as much love as she can in the few days or weeks her father has left. The movie's built almost completely of conversations among these three, most of them as aimless and pretty and slightly overwritten as this one, between Bogart and Birkin on a hotel terrace in Cannes.
Do you think that they've got whiskey clouds up there for the souls of poor alcoholics?
Well, if God exists, it's the least he could do.
Well, from what I know of him, he's not over bright.
Frightened?
No, no. I'm very, very angry. I'm not ready to leave the party. And I'm very irritated when I think life is going to stop suddenly, and more irritated to realize it'll go on without me. I don't care for that at all. We have a great talent for life, you and I. Don't waste it.
The three actors in Daddy Nostalgia are almost perfectly balanced. If Odette Laure is tart and stiff and frightened, Jane Birkin is overwhelmingly warm and passionate and mercurial. And when Birkin's gush gets to be a little too much, Dirk Bogarde's suave irony seems to rein her in. Bogarde's performance, in fact, is almost too beautiful. The character he plays has been a successful, hedonistic, mindlessly selfish man, and it's hard to know where the wisdom and profundity we see in his character could have come from. The movie's full of discrepancies like that, and yet, in the end, they don't seem to matter much, because Daddy Nostalgia isn't about its characters, it's about emotions, about the way they surge and ebb, the way they enter faces and leave them, about the traces they leave behind. Can you imagine such a thing from an American filmmaker? You don't come out of Daddy Nostalgia feeling completely satisfied, but you do come out feeling grateful that there's still such a thing as the French cinema.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Daddy Nostalgia is showing in New York and Los Angeles and opens wider early next month. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The 1960 Roman epic Spartacus is coming back to movie theaters, newly restored, with scenes that were censored from the original. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Tony Curtis about a censored scene from Spartacus that featured him and Laurence Olivier. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.